This episode of GT the Podcast is supported by Alcon.
This is Ike Ahmed.
And I'm Arsham Shaybani.
And we want to welcome you to GT the Podcast.
We're bringing this to you together with BMC and Glaucoma Today.
To offer audible insights into current topics in glaucoma care.
Presented by the authors of our latest, most read GT articles.
Check it out.
Welcome to another episode of Survey Says with Dr. Paul Singh, a special edition of GT the Podcast, in which Dr. Singh presents a real patient case from his practice and asks his guests to weigh in on how they would manage it. Today's episode features Drs. Tosin Smith and Jason Bacharach. The panel begins by delving into the current treatment paradigm for glaucoma, reviewing the benefits and challenges of having a wide array of options and how they approach decisions about surgical intervention. Next, they discuss the case in question, a 72-year-old white woman with moderate primary open-angle glaucoma and a history of trabeculectomy and cataract surgery. Recently, her IOP has risen to the low 20s despite being on three medications. Visual fields have progressed only slightly, but she is having issues with her medication compliance. The panel offers their thoughts regarding target pressure and overall goals for the patient. Later, they find out how their colleagues would approach this case based on the results of a poll of GT's audience conducted on social media. Tune in to Survey Says with Dr. Paul Singh.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to GT, the podcast Survey Says. This is Paul Singh out here in southeastern Wisconsin. So totally pumped to hang out with two really, really good friends, two amazing, amazing surgeons and educators, presenters, you name it, with me today to talk about a case. And what I love about Survey Says is it's really about discussing what all of us do, right? There's no right or wrong answer in glaucoma. That's what I love about glaucoma, right? Is you can do three, you can ask three different specialists and have three different answers of what's the best PGA, what's the best surgery. And we realize so much of what we do is based upon our gestalt, based upon our training, our outcomes, et cetera. And so that's kind of what all this is about, just talking about what we all do every day. And if we have differing opinions, that's the best part of it. So before we go further and talk about the case and talk about your responses on LinkedIn and Instagram, I want to introduce our have our panelists introduce themselves. So Jason, say hi and talk about where you're from, my friend.
It is so much fun to be here with two of my favorite people, innovators, great colleagues, and people that I love to learn from. So thank you for inviting me. My name is Jason Bacharach, and I've been in the Bay Area, San Francisco Bay Area, for my 31st year in practice, and I'm a glaucoma specialist out here. I co-direct the glaucoma division in San Francisco with my good friend and colleague, George Tanaka, and I have a research center and private practice in Sonoma County, California. So again, thank you for allowing me to be here.
Awesome. Looking forward to it. You're one of my heroes, my friend. And another hero of mine is Tosin Smith down here, down in Texas. Tosin, please share with us, the audience, kind of where you're from, what you do, and how amazing you are.
Hey, thank you for having me with Glaucoma Associates of Texas in Dallas. And I've been here for the past going on 13 years. I've done a little bit of academics, but it's wonderful practicing in Dallas with a big group of glaucoma specialists. There's a total of eight of us now. And, you know, it's amazing how, you know, eight people can be in the same practice and see one patient and we all sit around and decide we want to do different things for that one patient that's in front of us. So this is going to be a really entertaining conversation.
Yeah, there's going to be no right or wrong in this one, guys. And so thank you for the introductions. And I'm so happy to have both of you here because you guys have such enormous experience on the research side, the clinical side, and all the different MIGs and subconj surgery. And that's kind of the idea now, you know, before we get into detail on the case and talk about the results and the polling, just talk about in general now, kind of how do you view surgical intervention now? I mean, Tosin, I'll go with you first since I had Jason introduce himself first. What are your thoughts on how do you take all these options from conventional MIGs to subconj MIGs to subconj traditional surgery to lasers now? And do you view them as like silos or do you view them just this whole bucket and kind of talk about that kind of decision tree, if you don't mind?
So, you know, the new surgical procedures or the new glaucoma treatment paradigm that we have now is it's amazing. The way I see it is that I have limitless options. It allows me to look at the patient in front of me and make choices based off of what that patient presents to me. You know, the days of sort of being a little anxious about doing surgery on someone because you're weighing risk versus benefits because of traditional surgery are sort of further down the road. But we've started to see benefits of either intervening earlier, you know, as we talk about interventional glaucoma. We've suddenly seen the benefits of some of those surgeries that we used to intervene. And we know that these are sort of safer procedures that we can do on our patients that will help us achieve that goal, or physician goal of intraocular pressure control, but also those things that our patients yearn for in you know, disease control that is not taking a toll on their lifestyle. So how do I look at this? I think science has really helped. Some of the clinical trials that we have really helped. I'm that person who sort of knows how to do every single thing or most procedures, but will I have, with the science that's in front of me, realized that there are some things that I can do early in a patient, like SLT now. You know, we talk about SLT and being able to do that earlier on and the benefits of doing that just from the results of a light trial. We go ahead and take a look at the mixed procedures as a category, whether it's subconjunctival filtration, angle-based surgery into the different spaces we have there, whether it's a stent or trabecular stripping. And, you know, when I have to talk to people about it, I always say, at least make sure you know how to do one thing in each category. Then you can broaden your view, so to speak. But if you go into space, if you go into the canal, for instance, and that eventually fails, you have subconjunctival filtration to lean on. Or you can go back to sustained release drug option. There are just all these options. And I think they all work synergistically to help us take care of patients. So for me, it's limitless options. And, you know, I just go shopping. I look at that patient and I say, what's the best thing for you, depending on where you are in your journey, so to speak.
I love that. And I love to have Jason. That was a great overview. And I want to get Jason's thoughts on that, because to me, it's like, you know, we can pick now from this pick list of different options, depending on the patient's severity, where they are at the progression, what number of drops they're on, what's your target pressure. And Jason, talk about that. It's not like we have to have this like dogmatic linear progression for surgical options now. It can be like, yeah, you know, for one patient, it might be a subcon surgery first. Another patient might be SLT first. Another patient might be drug delivery. Talk about that and how we're changing from this dogmatic kind of linear progression versus this kind of options that we have.
I mean, it's a more sophisticated treatment approach, as it should be. I mean, if you think about the way we managed it when I started, and really up until 2012, when the first iStent was introduced into the U.S. marketplace, up until that time, I mean, we hit everything with a sledgehammer. The laser rarely worked because we were using an ALT. And, you know, we slathered the eye in medicines. We probably caused a lot of toxicity to the trabecular outflow and probably uveoscleral outflow apparatus based on histopathologic studies. And then we try a laser. It rarely worked. And, you know, such a different animal when you do an SLT first, like Tosin was alluding to. And then we really hit it with a sledgehammer. You know, we did a trab, or, you know, some people did a tube, and all the luggage that came along with that. So the game's completely different now. And it's a very individualized approach, again, echoing what Tosin said. But in some respects, it's more challenging to decipher which procedure or treatment's the best option for a patient, understanding the fiscalities around it for you as a surgeon, for your surgical center, for your patient coverage, and also the explanation that you have to have, the discussion that you have to have with a patient is more nuanced, because many of these procedures, whether it's GAPS or MIGS, guided administration of pharmaceuticals, or microincisional procedures, they might not lower the pressure as much as a tube or a trap, even bypass surgeries like Zen. So it is a more sophisticated playing field, and everything that comes along with that, the good and the bad, but I'd never want to go back.
No, that's a great point. I think that for me, it's also a different paradigm shift for me in the sense that my definition of what is control glaucoma now has also shifted. You know, before it was all about fields and nerves and pressures, et cetera. And now it's really about that. Plus, what is the likelihood of that patient staying compliant on that regimen long term? And if I feel personally that that patient has a poor likelihood, which we know from data, it's pretty much almost everybody, but you know, someone's like has a poor likelihood of staying on that regimen long term, that patient's not compliant. They're probably going to have fluctuating IOPs, and then depending on the patient, likely a progression might be higher. So that's where, to me now, it's like my definition, and I'd love to hear Tosin your thoughts on this too. Is has your definition also of not only control glaucoma but outcomes change now? Looking at outcomes, not just as absolute IOP reduction, but compliance and medication burden reduction. Talk about how important that is now in our definition of success with all these different surgeries.
That has changed so drastically. And it's not just from a physician's outlook, so to speak. The patients are requiring us to do that. Because more and more, there is a push towards being able to control chronic disease, but also have a life in addition to that. And, you know, the good thing about all of that is that we're at a time that allows us to do that. If we have to define what that means for me, it used to be IOP, it used to be visual field progression. It used to be, no matter what, we just have to stabilize disease. And we would say at that time that all we really want is to be able to have this patient see at the end of their life. But how about living life while you're alive?
Nice, yep.
You know, really, how about that? And that's what our patients are asking us for. They're asking us for ways of controlling, truly controlling disease in a way that will prevent progression, whether it's leaning on surgical procedures or lasers or technology that allows them to do a better job without incapacitating them in any way or preventing them from living life to the fullest. The days of using eye drops just persistently and staying with it because it didn't make you go blind when you had significant adverse events from the drops have gone because you didn't have options then. And so for me, the outcomes now involve encouraging my patients to engage. What to you would be the best thing here. So my goal is to control your pressure, but these are the options that you have that we can use to do that. What is your life? Tell me about that. Is it in the cost? Is it in not doing drops? Is it, I can tell you the science of it. And we come to this compromise that allows us to reach those outcomes where if your patient actually stays with therapy because they can, they were involved in making those choices. And that allows you long-term, you know, keep disease from progressing in a significant way. So definitely it has become more engaging for all that are involved.
So Jason, to that point about progression, and really I want to go back to patient education because, you know, Tosin brought up a good point about how, you know, we have a discussion with our patients, we kind of figure out what's important to them. Is it cost? Is it, you know, compliance, drops, et cetera? So when you're with a patient, and this is, I think, an issue that I think a lot of colleagues have with just managing glaucoma surgically. It's like, you know, how do you educate the patient appropriately, managing expectations? Because what the fear of MIGS, especially conventional outflow MIGS, is it's not going to work. Am I going to deliver on my promise, especially a standalone MIGS for that matter, right? Forget cataract combo. So how do you have that discussion? What do you talk to patients about managing expectations, what to expect in the future if it doesn't work? Talk a little bit about that if you don't mind.
Yeah, let me give you a real quick, I love anecdotal stories because they really summarize things. And both of you, I think, were at the first microincisional glaucoma surgical meeting. I think we're calling it glaucoma. It's coming up now.
The IGC? IGC?
Yeah, the IGC.
Yeah.
And so I don't know if you remember, but Nate Radcliffe came in and there was, you know, at that point, it was a very small meeting. Arsham and Ike and Rick Lewis were moderating it. And there was 100 people invited. And what was really interesting to me at that meeting was, you know, they invited Nate Radcliffe to talk about standalone MIGS. And this wasn't that long ago. It was a few years ago. And Nate said, you know, how many people in this room are doing standalone MIGS regularly? And this was only a few years ago. Hardly anybody raised their hand. The most innovative glaucoma surgeons in the world were in that room. And Nate made it clear why. He was right on the money. He said, the reason is when you do phaco and a MIGS, you know, it's the MIGS is like, oh yeah, and the pressure went down, you know, because the patient's happy. To Tosin's point, the vision's better. You know, the phaco probably helped lower the pressure a little bit, even if the MIGS didn't do its job. And so you got a mulligan with the MIGS when you did it with the cataract. But when you're going in there and your ultimate goal is just to lower the pressure, I think that's the sketch part for some clinicians out there. You know, they may have done a KDB blade, a goniotomy or an Omni. And now there's a stent that you can use, the Infinite, right? Standalone, on label. And so we have these options, and maybe a surgeon picked bad protoplasm. You know, the TM was shot. It was somebody that really needed a bypass surgery. And they went in there and they did their first, standalone MIGS, and it didn't work. And they're like, I'm referring it out, or I'm going back to a trab, or I'm going back to a tube. And it was just that patient wouldn't have done well in anybody's hands. So there's a lot to learn about this. I try to do a lot of my education remotely now. I'm using some head-mounted headgear from a company that I'm the medical director of to offer patient education. I really try to limit my time. I try to give the patient websites and information that they can go home and read about, because it can be a very long, complex conversation. And then sometimes I'll schedule a follow-up visit before the surgery to answer questions. So I really try to be efficient with my time. We're all overwhelmed right now.
Yeah, no, great points. And, I think you're absolutely right about the fact that standalone was a lot more pressure on us to basically deliver on that outcome. And the outcome is not for me anymore only about IOP reduction. And I think I get this, and this is a simple anecdotal story, but I remember a few years back I had a call or an email from a colleague said, hey, Paul, I don't think X, Y, and Z MIGS worked on me or on that patient. It was a standalone MIGS. And I said, why? Well, patient's pressure was 16, before surgery. Now they're 18. I'm like, oh man, they went up, huh? He's like, yeah. I'm like, well, so how many, is he still on the same drops? Oh no, he's not the drops, but his pressure's higher. I'm like, and I was laughing in my mind, and I wasn't trying to make fun of the doc. I was just thinking, like, this is what I'm saying. This is the hard part about, we're so focused. We were trained so hard on absolute IOP reduction, reduce pressure, low target. And we realized that sometimes, man, it doesn't have to be that low. Sometimes it's just stability and getting people off those meds and getting that whole inflammatory cascade of the trabecular meshwork and the, the distal collector channels, all that chilled out with less common chemicals, et cetera. And I think that to me is part of this new wave of how we define success and how we also are able to feel more comfortable talking to patients and say, hey, look, don't worry about the pressure specifically. Let's worry about the holistic approach. You having a high quality of life, like Tosin said, and let's control the pressure. If it's a couple points higher, it's okay. Let's keep it more stable. And I think that choice of not having to be choosing between quality of life and addressing IOP at the same time, that choice used to be something we had to make. We don't have to make that choice anymore. And I think that's the key for me. And I think also what I want to bring up before we get to our case is this idea of mechanism of action. I think what MIGS has done for me, and I'd love to hear your thoughts, is we're kind of thinking about it. Like, Jason, we talked about the days of, Notarcidil and latanoprost and Bunodin, the kind of the pharmaceutical world talking about outflow. But even in the MIGS world now, right? Is it TM? Is it the canal, the collector channels? And then, bypass, when do we bypass? Is that a big part of your thought process? I mean, Tosin, you want to mention, just talk about that process?
I think what we do now, our options now allow us to actually think more critically about what we do next. It allows us to go and look at the pathophysiology or the pathology involved with disease, the pathophysiology of outflow, the specific diagnosis in front of us, and actually think about using those tools that we have in front of us. We know that further along in patients who have sort of more advanced glaucoma, that the episcleral vessels may be atrophied and not so functional just because they're of the fibrosis at the level of the TM. In some instances, you may have a situation where those things are still functional. And, I actually have that conversation with patients about explaining how this works, the different layers that are there, and how, probably early on, while you still have some functionality at the level of that TM, Schlemm's canal, and collector channels, it's better to tap into that. Then you start using all the other outflow pathways that are there. I think it's just priceless being able to do this versus what we had before, which was just go straight to a trabeculectomy or a tube shunt. Try and revive or rejuvenate, which is what I actually use. I borrowed that phrase from you about doing SLTs earlier. And that conversation, actually, patients like to hear. I think in the past, you know, I used to think that it was the patients that was in the way of doing early SLTs, but I realized that it wasn't the patient. I was in the way of it. And it was in that conversation that I had because of just actually absolutely believing in the technology. But I say science always just, when science proves a fact, then it makes it easy for you. So pathophysiology is key. Science, being able to prove some of the things that we now know better, also helps you make that case to the patients to say, you know what, we're going to do this for you because it is in your best interest based off of what we know now.
No, that is great. And I think, you know, Jason, I have a quick question because what Tosin mentioned was important, right? Mechanism of action, where is the resistance to outflow? And we were taught traditionally that if you do a trabeculectomy, you bypass the conventional outflow pathway, it's gone. Bye-bye. See you later. Don't even address it again. What are your thoughts on readdressing the conventional pathway? And we're kind of getting to a little bit of a hint here of the case we're going to present. But I mean, talking about mechanism, do you think that it is viable in your experience and theoretically to go back to the conventional pathway?
In some cases, but in some cases not. I mean, listen, there's people that their whole career, they worked on the, Murray Johnstone, Paul Kaufman, you know, leaders of the past generation in our world that, you know, if you looked at their work, looking at the TM, they would tell you, you know, don't let it get shot to begin with. And you know, the only way that the trabecular meshwork gets nutrition is through aqueous. And you might say, that's impossible. I mean, I cut into Schlemm's and there's blood all over the anterior chamber of the eye, right? But there's no blood that gets into the TM. All the nutrition comes from aqueous. And so if you divert the aqueous away, okay, I'll give you a perfect example. This will say it all. If you ever had an inadvertent ciliary cleft, you know, a traumatic cleft, and you left it there for a really long time, and the TM just was getting no flow, you had a hypotenuse eye, the pressure's 3, somebody sat on it for years, you know, the patient had hypotony maculopathy, and they get referred to you. You're the high pressure guy, but maybe you're the low pressure guy too. And they said, hey, Paul or Tosin, can you close this cleft for me? 100% of the time, you'll probably get that cleft closed. And almost 100% of the time, you're going to get a call at midnight that night from the patient vomiting and sick. Yeah. And the pressure is 70. So, you know, I mean, in some eyes, the TM gets shot because there was no aqueous going through. So I think about that now because I have options. I didn't have options before, so I didn't think about it. So it's great. And we're learning, you know. And so what Tosin said, I would agree with 100% if I can continue to percolate through. This case will be interesting because this is somebody that, you know, had a trab already. So I don't want to steal the thunder, but it's a great leading question.
Just referencing the GATT paper that talked about doing GATS, which is ab interno trabeculotomy in patients who've had prior incisional surgery. And just referencing that paper, we had patients in that study that had significant intraocular pressure reduction. And the paper actually specifically had patients who had had prior trabeculectomies and prior tube shunts. And you had like the trabeculectomy group with a preoperative intraocular pressure of about 25 millimeters of mercury on 3 medicines. And at 24 months, it was 16 on 2.1 medication. So in certain in many instances, you can, like Jason said, just reawaken trabecular mesh work as long as the outflow beyond that is wide open.
The infinite study that Glaukos just finished up, what a great study, right? That showed very similar. And, you know, Tosin has an incredible experience with GATT, right? She's with Ron down there. And, I mean, their group really were at the forefront of this type of surgical maneuver for many years before many of us. And, you know, their data is so powerful with a relatively inexpensive procedure. But the Infinite study showed really interesting, cool results in people that had prior surgery as well. So, yeah, I mean, it'd be great if we could use some type of, you know, Paul, you do a little bit of staining of outflow pathway. Let's turn the camera on you. Is there any way for us to know who's going to do well and who's not with these procedures?
That is a really good point. I would say anecdotally, when you see a patient where there's some, when you decompress the eye and you see some reflux from the EVP, from the episcleral venous system into the Schlemm's canal, and you can see that red build up there, I've had some good experience with that. I think there's definitely some distal collector channel patency. I think for me, it's all about the distal collector channels. Honestly, more and more I do this, and that's where we just don't know kind of the status preoperatively. The TM absolutely, this just genesis is an important thing, but let's say you do a GAT and, you know, kind of remove it. You know, if you have a good episcleral venous system, as patent, you have good connection there, you should do really well post-GAT, right? But if you don't, then doesn't matter how much you can rip everything up. It doesn't matter. And so that's kind of my anecdotal. But I think, you know, to your point about the infant, I was part of the infant trials and I was surprised, to be honest with you. You know, the infant trial, again, for those who don't know, the Glauco study looked at patients with previous history of, you know, TRABs, tubes, surgeries, or maximal tolerated medical therapy. And they had like almost 47 or 50% of patients almost have like 30% reduction of IOP and same or less meds. I mean, that was, it blew me away because I was one of the investigators. And I was like, holy cow. And doing GAD on these, some of these patients who had previous TRAB, I was like, holy cow, it does work in some patients. So I think yes and no. It depends on severity, depends on other risk factors that we don't even know. And I think the more sophisticated we get in diagnostics too, Jason, the more we can really understand preoperatively where the resistance outflow is. If we could have a way to really truly understand blood flow preoperatively in a non-invasive way, that would give us so much more of an understanding of what is the best procedure and what's the best technology for that one patient. We're not there yet, but I think we'll get there eventually. but great segue. I'm just going to, for the sake of time, move forward because I want to just spend time on this case and have you guys kind of comment, and then we'll see what the audience out there, which you guys all out there did and said, and we'll go from there. So the case, just to remind everybody, I'm going to read it out again, and then we'll go to some of the polling questions and get Tosin and Jason to comment. So
this episode of GT the Podcast is supported by Alcon.
72-year-old Caucasian female with a history of moderate open-angle glaucoma, POEG, history of a trabeculectomy, okay, and had subsequent cataract surgery a few years after that. So a few years ago, had cataract surgery. So history of TRAB, post-TRAB, had a cataract. Recently, the pressure started to rise into the low 20s, despite being on basically three medications, a PGA and a combination drop, okay? Bleb is starting to get fibrose, scarred down, kind of flattened out when by the time she saw me. Complains of fluctuating vision, too, and having some issues of redness from the drops and dry eye, and complains of, you know, kind of can't read for more than a few minutes. Typical ocular surface disease type of issues there. And she says my eyes feel better when she doesn't take her medications. Gonio, the angle was actually open. Serrated body band, there was no significant PAS, thankfully. So great TRAB surgeon, whoever did the TRAB. And then visual fields have really not progressed rapidly. There's some small changes going on, but nothing that was drastic over the last few years. So no central 10 degrees. So moderate glaucoma, no defect in the central 10 degrees. So this is a patient who's not really rapidly progressing, but having some compliance issues. Pressures are higher, the 20s. I didn't tell you the cup to disc ratio is about 0.75 cup to disc ratio as well. And the other eye is about a 0.6, more mild to moderate glaucoma. This is the one that had the TRAB. Other eye did not have a TRAB and is on medications also. So we'll get to that later. But with that said, history of TRAB, pressures in the low 20s, on three meds, has not really progressed rapidly. What are you thinking in terms of, I'm going to ask you guys all together, what are your target pressures and what are your goals for this patient? Okay, Tosin, you're first.
So, first of all, definitely moderate disease here. And this is, let me go back. This is a patient who has probably enjoyed a time that they've been off of drops and slowly, gradually to come back to this place where there are multiple medications. Target pressure for me, depending on where they started from, will be at least mid to upper teens here. Mid to upper teens at the very worst case scenario. In terms of, you know, what I would like to see in whatever I do next, at least to get the patient into that range and off of as many of these drops as possible. So for me, it's a drop reduction intervention in this particular case, if we can make sure that there is no continued progression in the patient's disease.
Yeah, and by the way, for the record, this is a patient you don't have a lot of history on. She wasn't referred. She just came and moved here. So we don't have a lot of old records, no visual field. So that's kind of where we're kind of saying, okay, now what do we do? So Jason, what do you think in this case?
People move to Wisconsin?
It's a crazy thought, but they actually do, man. I don't know what. It's the Cheeseheads, man. It's the Packers. It's the beer. It's all good, man. You got to come.
I know they love you there because I've seen a couple of patients that your dad and you took care of, and you guys are generationally beloved.
My dad. Yeah. I'm dovetailing off of him. But yeah, man. No, what do you think, though? Tell me. You think she would just...
Well, you know, I love these kind of cases. You know, chew them up. How's everybody going to manage it? You know, but when I look at the case, a couple of things. First of all, how this patient was managed is how I used to manage patients. And nothing that was done is anything I would do now. I wouldn't have done a TRAB first. I wouldn't have not managed the cataract first because, you know, I would have taken the cataract out first now, even if it was a mild to moderate cataract, and got the lens out of the eye and done something in the angle. And I wouldn't be stuck with a scarred down TRAB in a pseudophakic patient. Now with that said, if I don't know this patient and I don't have a great rapport, I'm going to go against the grain. You know, I know this is kind of a surgical talk, but I may try a preservative-free fixed combo. What I think the worst thing to do, the pearl, is if somebody has a failing TRAB, adding medicines back in with benzalkonium chloride. I mean, Cindy Hutnick's study, the PESO study, preservatives effect on surgical outcome study. Cindy Hutnick's from Canada, but you know, it's called the PESO study. And that study demonstrated clearly there was a direct correlation between benzalkonium chloride, the amount of drops that were on board, and failure of trabeculectomy. So I would have, you know, in this case, if I'm going to add back meds, they have to be preservative free. I would have used a fixed combo, to Tosin's point, to reduce the meds. And you know what? That there's nothing wrong with doing that, especially if you don't have a good rapport with a patient. You just met them. You're in a busy clinic. They had a failed surgery already. They're pissed off maybe. Maybe you want to have another meeting with them before you meet them with a mask on in an operating room. And there's nothing wrong with trying a preservative-free option. With that said, I'll also go against the grain. Maybe I won't give up on that TRAB yet, you know, and maybe I'll take a little ophthetic in the office and put it on a WEC cell and see if there's some mobile conge over that old TRAB site. And if there was any mobility at all, I might needle it. And that's an easy conversation. You know, before I go on and do another procedure, I don't want to mess with real estate for sure with a 72-year-old on the front of the eye. If I'm not going to go MIGS, maybe I try to needle it in the office with some anti-metabolites. And you know what? Even if it works 25% of the time, that's all right. And so, so they're kind of outside of the box things that I might do. And then thinking, of course, of MIGs and medicines, you know, alternatively delivered pharmaceutical products in the anterior chamber, another option that you can use here.
Yeah, and I love that. I mean, first of all, and that's such a good, important pearl. When you see a patient for the first time who's had a, let's say, complicated or a complex history, let's say, rather, you know, the last thing you want to do is rush to do a surgery that may not give you, not be as clear of an outcome that you're going to have. And then you'd be the one stuck to the last surgery you did, even though they had multiple surgeries before. So it's always a good idea to kind of talk to the patient, say, we try all the things conservatively if you need to. And I love that idea. And I think also drug delivery, you're absolutely right about that. We think of drug delivery only, you know, like Durysta and others coming out in the future as more of a mild patient, first, second line, third line patient. But, you know, after TRABs and tubes, I've done them and they actually do really well for a lot of these patients. So again, I think the focus for me in this patient, yeah, is get them off the medications as much as possible or decrease the drop burden or the preservative load, like you said, Jason. It's really, really good points. If you tried all that, and the patient, let's say, didn't tolerate the meds, couldn't afford the meds, let's say meds was not an option, because I think it's a great point. We should always consider meds as still an option for a lot of our patients. We kind of harp on them and attack them, but I still use meds on everybody as much as I love to get them off meds. But what would you do surgically if, let's say, you tried the med world, you tried the preservative-free world, it wasn't working for that patient? What would you do now, surgically?
Tosin, what would you do?
Tosin, you first. As the old man of the group, we'll give you that. You're mulligan.
I 100%, first of all, agree with going back to needle that bleb. If there is a chance that you can get the trabeculectomy back to working again, you know, it allows you to just use that because eventually it will work for a time and it will come to that place where you need to do something else. But if in this particular patient, I have to intervene surgically, then I have options. Okay. Do I, go to a mixed surgery that is conventional, you know, with a stent or because we have results, we have science to back that will work. Do I go to a trabecular stripping procedure? Do I go to a different subconjunctival outflow procedure? So if I have to sort through that, if I have to go subconjunctivally, I will definitely needle that old bleb for starters. But if I want to do something here based off of the patient's glaucoma and stage of disease and where I'm trying to go in terms of that target that we started with, I will probably go to, I will do a goniotomy on this patient. I will do a goniotomy, the extent of it, whether it's, a couple of clock hours versus a 360 degree ab interno trabeculotomy. We may say I'm biased. I see you smiling over there.
But we know where you're going. No, it's a good though. I'm gonna push you in that. I think that's such a great point that you made. The whole definition of goniotomy and 90 degrees versus more pointed goniotomies over a certain span of clock hours. Any thoughts? I mean, you don't have to go specific, but just any thoughts on the size of the otomy and does that correlate truly to outcomes? Do you feel that way clinically, surgically? I mean, do you feel like anecdotally? What are your thoughts?
So there are probably no big comparison studies out there between the extent of the goniotomies that you do, but in people who do something like a hemigap, they see the efficacy as they would if you did a 360 degree gap, so to speak. So if the important thing is to direct your goniotomy, if I did a goniotomy, I always make sure I head into that area where we believe that the collector channels are concentrated in that infranasal quadrant. At least I make sure I get that. I would also at least get as much as possible 120 to 160 degrees of that nasal angle open. I have seen patients who have done a 360 degree GAT and their pressures are just low and they've been low for many years. I have a patient that has a pressure of 10 for the past, and I tell this story all the time. It's anecdotal. It was my first GAT patient. His pressure was 40. He had pseudo-exfoliation glaucoma. I did a GAT on him. His pressure is 10. I see him twice a year, and it's been 12 years. It's what it is. He's on no drops.
Yeah, that's
TMI. That's what the pathology was. But, we have to, I would say, could it have worked if I did 180 degrees? Maybe. Maybe that's all he needed. And so I don't have any perfect numbers. I would say just always I tend to make sure that infranasal quadrant where there's a high density of collector channels is at least open. If I can get a little bit more in the nasal angle, I definitely do that with my goniotomies.
Jason, real quick on what Tosin said. How many, and again, this is, I'm not asking you for like real data here, just more your thoughts. How many collector channels do you think we have to access to get significant efficacy? Do you think all we need is one? Like if we get next to a nice large collector channel, do you think that's all we need? Is just one?
Well, it's very controversial. I mean, there's 10 to 12 in the inferior nasal quadrant, and studies of cadaver eyes have found that. But, some people would say you don't want to be near the collector channels. You want to be away from the collector channels for anatomic reasons. And, I'm not going to answer that question, but I will say that to Tosin's point on clock hours, her partner, her partner did a study showing that if you do 180, there wasn't much different. And he presented it at the American Glaucoma Society. I mean, Ron's an incredible knowledge base on this. There was really no difference between 360 and 180. And Ray Brown who's the medical director of Sight Science, who has Omni, that obviously it also does some distal opening, but proximally, there really was no difference between 180 and 360 in his hands in one of his early studies. So, I usually, if I'm going to do a cutter, I'll usually, do 360 of, let's say I'm going to use the Omni, I'll do 360 canaloplasty and 180 goniotomy, but I don't know if I agree with Toaster. There's not a lot of hard science out there. And others have done some anecdotal studies, Jella on goniotomy by itself with a KDB blade. Seems like 4 clock hours was all you needed to get the maximal benefit in her study. She presented that at the American Glaucoma Society. So there's still a lot to learn about this. Now, Paul, I'm going to tell you what Paul would do. Everybody out there. Paul would do 180 of goniotomy, canaloplasty, and then he'd put like a hydrus in the other angle, and then he'd figure out a way to put an iDose in there just in case, you know, he wanted some pharmaceutical options. So he's the king of bling. So I'm going to turn it over to you, Paul. What would you do for this patient?
All right. I will answer that question, but I'm going to choose moderator privilege and answer at the end. No, but yeah, the more, whatever's cool to show a video right now. I do take into consideration mechanism of action. I really do. And I think I have drunk the Kool-Aid when it comes to pressurized viscodilation. I do think there's something to be said about viscodilating, whether it helps stretch the TM, open the canal, as well as flush the distal clutch of channels in a closed system, right? And then doing some type of an otomy, like in this kind of case. I look at my data, and it's not published to be fair and balanced, but we have seen no significant difference between 180 and 360. And in fact, looking at even 100 degrees, or like a 90 to 100, even 180, not a significant difference there either. So my personal opinion is if you get close to a couple collector systems that are functioning and doing well, you can get pretty significant efficacy with those. That's just my personal opinion. But with that said,
I would just interject. I agree with that, because a lot of times when you're, you know, let's say you're using Sight Sciences tool or even Glaukos's tool that does a very similar procedure, sometimes you don't get the full 180. You know, you might get 120 or 160. And I anecdotally don't think there's much of a difference either if you do get the full 180. And again, it's really, we're just leaning on the shoulders of people like Ron Feldman, who, you know, has done so much work in this area.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So no, and I'll tell you at the end what I did, but I want to get your thoughts, guys, on the polls. And so thanks for that. So we thought middle teens, try to decrease the drop burden for this patient, address some of the symptoms of dry eye for the patient, get her off of meds. So that middle teens, upper teens is what we thought. At least what you guys both had said, at least. And then next step, we talked about the fact that we can either add or switch medication to preservative-free combos. There's a number of different ways you can do that, different products that are out there for that. And if you do surgery, both of you said that if you could needle that bleb, there's some conge that's mobile enough, take a Wexel or a sponge, just look at it and see if it's, you can move something around, maybe try to needle it, open the office, get some flow, at least get her off of some meds. It'd be great. If not, try the conventional MIGS, maybe doing a GAT, or whatever, 360, 180, combine it maybe with some canaloplasty. And then if it's conventional MIGS, also, I'll tell you in a second what I did, but let's take a look and see what the audience said. And you guys nailed it, actually. So the audience said the same thing. In fact, George Durr said, hey, bleb needling would be my first next step. So absolutely, I think that was a really good point here. This is on Instagram here. And someone said the target pressure depends on the pressure that the patient was progressing at. That is really important. Talk, if you guys want to just mention that too for all our colleagues out there, you know, when we talk about target pressures, we always think, okay, they're progressing, we have to get the pressure down to low teens. But sometimes they're progressing at a pressure of like low 20s, and maybe it's getting compliance improved and getting to upper teens is fine. Talk about that. Like, how do we decide target pressure? Is it only on severity, or what else do you guys use?
I've set targets for patients, and due to compliance, they may, you know, fluctuate slightly above their targets. And then I'm following their visual fields. I give them flexibility, and I say they're not progressing at that number. And so, you know, we usually start with that, okay, just if you start treating the patient, it's easy to come up with, okay, 35% reduction in pressure, or come up with a number that you think is way less than where you started from. If you started at 35, you would think that something in the upper teens will definitely be more tolerable for that nerve. It doesn't have to be 12. But I have over time come to realize that sometimes we stretch too far in setting targets for patients. And it's important to set a reasonable target, but more importantly, it's important to watch for progression, whether it's in the visual field or an OCT, doing testing more frequently if you need to. And if you see progression, be comfortable resetting your target. It's not to get lost in the, we set a target here and it's going to remain there forever, but to be vigilant and watching those things that will help you change, reset your target, sometimes up, I have done that, or sometimes lower as you need to in any particular patient.
Really, really good point. I totally agree with you on that one. And I think that's the problem too, is that this whole idea of what's the contribution of poor compliance in relation to the progression. And if that is a significant, at least for me, a rationale for why the patient might have progressed, then yeah, sometimes I'm like, you know, progress pressure may not be that low. And, you know, then I think I love, you know, Arshav Shabani has a great spiel on this and says, hey, look, you know, we're the only subspecialty in medicine that pushes our treatments to sub and therapeutic or subnormal values, like, right? Like blood pressure, we don't go down like, you know, 80 over 40, you know, for blood pressure if someone is hypertensive, right? You know, or diabetes, we don't get them, you know, blood sugar down to 40. We're like, you know, in the normal range. And so I think we kind of push these sub 10s for some patients that may not necessarily be that low as well. So that's some interesting comment from one of our, from our colleagues. So I appreciate that. Well, most of the people out there, like, we look at Instagram and LinkedIn, said that middle teens was kind of the, where they thought the pressure should be. Some said lower teens, which is understandable, and some even said upper teens. So yeah, there's no right or wrong. I think as long as you're following patients, looking for progression, talking to patients about the next steps if they're not quite at that target range. And if you don't get there to sell a patient, it's okay. Let's just follow you now the way you are, and you're better than you were before, and let's see if you're stabilized as well. And then we talked about looking at what's the next step if you do surgery. Some people said add medications, 20% said add medications. But it was interesting, if you look at the Instagram world, there was really almost a split between doing another TRABS or a MIBS, let's say, right? Like, let's say a Zen or some type of, you know, who knows if you're overseas and the pressure flow, or doing a conventional MIGS. 45% said conventional MIG, 33% said another subcon surgery on Instagram. And on LinkedIn, the combination was mostly conventional MIGs, actually. So less for another TRAB or tube and less for medication. So interesting. LinkedIn felt conventional outflow, and then Instagram said maybe a mix between either conventional outflow MIGs or another TRAB or tube, which I thought was interesting. Again, no right or wrong answer, everybody. It's kind of your comfort level as well.
So I got a question for both of you. Since all of the innovations that have come now, both of you have pathology laden practices like me, but you know, you see everything. And since all of these innovations, including like Zen, we don't have preservative flow here, but Zen in the US, with all of these options that we have now, have you done a lot less TRABS?
Oh my God, yeah. I mean, it's scary. I mean, look, I think a TRAB is still a wonderful surgery. And I know I keep talking about MIBS and MIGs and everything else, and I never talk about TRABS anymore, but I still do them if I have to. And I say if I have to, because there are those cases where it is the best surgery for the patient, and it's powerful and it works really well if it's done well and you have the right kind of conge.
But you've done a lot less of them.
Heck yeah. Thankfully. Yeah.
And, yes, and if you see somebody that you think you're thinking TRAB, in the back of your mind, you're thinking Zen.
Absolutely. Most of the time I'll do a Zen before I do a TRAB.
See?
And a TRAB is like after. I mean, you know, I not to say that I'm like the perfect Zen surgeon. I mean, we have our failures, we have our fibrosis, we have
of
our
course. Feelings.
But I will say I'm getting better and better at getting down to those low teens consistently, you know, and knowing how to, you know, kind of the surgical technique and then the post-op management and the 5-FUs and the mitomycins that we use, et cetera. So I'm feeling pretty confident in my personal ways of getting the pressures down. But yeah, Tosa, what are your thoughts on that? Are you doing mostly Zens or TRABS?
I'm doing fewer TRABS because I was used to be referred to as the TRAB queen, but I'm doing fewer TRABS, but I still do, you know, a lot of TRABS. We have a lot of pathology. And by the time some of those patients come to you, I think the other thing we have now is that everybody's catching on to what the options are for some of our patients. So by the time a patient is referred to you, sometimes they've had their angle surgery, they've had a Zen maybe in one quadrant, and you're like, okay, this is my opportunity to get a TRAB in there before we move on to a drainage implant. I think it's a skill that everybody still needs to know how to do, but I'm thankful for the fact that I don't have to do it in this patient, for instance. Just like Jason said, if this patient was a patient that I saw 15, 20 years ago, I hate to date myself, then trabeculectomy was it. But if now we have so many options that the likelihood that this patient in this stage of glaucoma would have a trabeculectomy without having a significant visual field loss or some big indication to go for it, it's just not there.
That's a great question, Jason. So I'll tell you what I did, and I'll ask you guys this question. I did a combination of canaloplasty, otomy, and I put some iStent infinites in. So kind of what Jason was saying. So I was kind of laughing. It's like he knows me way too well. But no, the idea, look, the idea was, let's do this viscodilation.
There's actually an online betting site, and everybody that bet on I won money on Paul Singh just now.
I love it. So you were absolutely right. So look, the rationale, everybody, because it's not just about like cool eye candy videos. It's also about understanding for me personally, look, if you can flush the system out, right, you're hedging your bets. You don't know where the resistance is. You don't know where the collector channels really are that are activated and are patent. So let's just flush it out. And let's do a little canaloplasty and then do some otomy, right? Just get some opening there. And then if you already have the area that still has healthy or has TM that's not been ripped or moved, put a couple stents in it. We have now a standalone indication for the infinite. And so I said, hey, let's combine the idea of all these different mechanisms, especially in a patient who's already had a TRAB and you don't want to go back and do the conventional pathway again in the least invasive way, still maintaining some natural architecture. That was the thought process. And the patient actually did really well. Patient actually is off of medication. His pressure is around 17 or so. So doing really well on that kind of regimen for me. Not everybody gets that. Some people have to do a TRAB or tube afterwards. But there wasn't a lot of people in the audience that polled that actually picked combination MIGS. And I'm a big fan of combo. Now there's a question about cost. Is it worth it? You're adding more cost to the healthcare industry or healthcare system if you're combining. But Jason, love to hear your thoughts. Do you combine different mechanisms in general? We talked about canal and otomy with the Omni or other devices, but do you combine stenting with those kind of different devices too?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a great option. You could do a stent, you could do a Hydrus with it. And it makes sense, right? Because a lot of times some of the scanning electron microscopy and histopathologic examinations of post cutters and post, cutters in particular, they close up. So, you know, if you open it up, and then in an adjacent quadrant, you can, you know, place a device there, that makes a lot of sense for the patient, for maybe the longer haul. I think we need studies to corroborate it, which aren't out there yet. And there are some issues on the economic front as to what procedures you can do with what procedures. So I'm a little bit conservative because I don't want an audit at my surgical center. But with that said, staying within the parameters of what is allowed, I think it's a great idea. And I can't wait to start doing it with some pharmacologic options.
Oh, yeah.
For example, maybe with iDose, which we'll have available in the near future.
Yeah, no, I mean, Tosin, what are your thoughts? Great points, Jason. I mean, I love doing combo like viscodilation and Hydrus too. I mean, Hydrus scaffolds it, bypasses TM, you flush it first with the canal dilation. It just makes so much sense mechanistically. Thoughts on that, Tosin, and added other combinations?
You know, what I'm really looking forward to is a time when we can have canalograms, whether in the clinic or in the operating room, to really help us direct what we do. But in the meantime, what we have is what we have, and just based off of the science of it, obviously going and being able to dilate the canal and do a pressure dilation is very beneficial. And then you do an otomy, hoping that distal pathway opens, or if there's any obstruction or collection. I saw a very interesting video of Dr. Kiami's where he was doing a viscodilation and he had stained the viscoelastic with Vision Blue, and you could just see just this micro, whether they're micro fractures on the TM or so, that and that viscoelastic, or there was seeping back in the anterior chamber of that material. And, you know, being able to stretch the TM and to flush things out and make sure there's a pathway that allows drainage beyond that is really helpful. And hopefully in the future soon, I hope somebody out there is listening and is working on this to help us better decide all of the different, whether it's stents or procedures we have, help us direct what we do in a way that we're beneficial for patients would just be wonderful.
I just have to say one thing, just to toot our own intraoperative OCT horn in our surgical center, in our office. We actually have a couple of videos out there on utilizing the iTrack catheter and really showing that when you kind of click that clicker, right, so to speak, or turn that button or that wheel, you're flushing viscoelastic into the canal. We can see real time, actually, with intraoperative OCT, the canal dilating, but more importantly, the distal collector channels go whoop. And then the TM stretching. So to your point with that dye, well, in intraoperative OCT, you can see real time. And so the question we don't have the answers to also is, does volume make a difference? And also, does amount of pressure going into the canal as you're introducing viscoelastic? Does that make a difference? And the type of viscoelastic? These are all questions that we don't have answers to, but I think are really interesting questions that we'll hopefully answer. And I think there are people working on different kind of diagnostics, which we think is going to take us to the next level as well. Hey guys, I think I probably should stop here because already like I could keep going. You have no idea. I geek out. Like, this is my therapy. So you guys are awesome, but I'm going to have to call it there now. But any last comments, Jason or Tosin, on what we talked about today? Anything for the audience?
So for me, it's just exciting to see all the responses, the polls, and to see how far we have traveled. How you know, not just the glaucoma community, but even the general ophthalmologists, how, you know, training programs, how we've all engaged in that process of learning all the new tools we have in glaucoma and using them for the benefit of the patient. So exciting times, even though we may not all do the same thing, it's just awesome to be able to see all the options we have.
Love it. Jason, I'll give you the last word now.
Well, first of all, thank you, Paul, for... And by the way, watching you over the past, geez, how long have you been practice now?
I'm an old man now. Don't we have to say it? Long enough, man.
Are you two decades in?
Almost. My daughter's 18. Yeah, and she's 19. So I started when she was born. So close. I'm getting there.
And Tosin, you're about the same vintage, aren't you?
I'm actually about 25 years.
Are you really?
Hey, you look good.
You just look good. You look less warm than Paul.
Impressive, man.
But, you know, just I would say this is an example, this podcast, of, you know, a great collegial forum to be able to discuss things that we deal with every day in our practice and to really learn from our colleagues. And thank you for, you know, allowing me to be part of it. I love all the work that you're both doing, and I really appreciate being part of this.
Back at you, my friend. Thank you both, Tosin and Jason, for really a fun discussion. This was more fun than anything else, and that's kind of why I was like so excited to talk tonight. So thank you for that, and thank you everybody out there for tuning in. I know there's a lot of things going on out there, and to just the fact that you guys stuck around and listened to us, it was an honor, and hopefully there was some pearls that you guys had learned that could help you in your practices. So thank you. Stay tuned for another episode in the future. Thanks to GT Podcast for hosting this, and until next time, take care, everybody.
Thank you for tuning into this episode of GT the Podcast. If you have any feedback or topic suggestions, find us on Instagram, LinkedIn, Facebook, or Twitter. And stay tuned for more hot topics in glaucoma care on GT the Podcast.